Welcome to the Helping Children Thrive podcast, where we talk about ways to improve your child's health and recovery. I'm your host, Momina Salim, and I'm a certified pediatric functional medicine health coach. At Helping Children Thrive, it is our aim to educate and empower parents and practitioners with integrative approaches to children's health conditions. Along with this hope that our children can recover, I welcome you all. Hi, everyone. I'm so excited today to have Dr. Bryce Applebaum with me. A little background on Dr. Bryce. He is on a mission to change the way the world views vision. He believes there is more to vision than just 20/20 eyesight and has developed programs to retrain the brain to revise the eyes. He's here with us today to discuss the missed diagnosis and missed opportunities of vision, why healthcare has it all wrong about the eyes. Dr. Bryce has a special interest in working with children and with adults with behavior and developmental visual dysfunctions. He is specifically interested in designing vision improvement treatment programs involving vision therapy, sports vision therapy, guided preschool development, to name just a few, and treating learning-related vision problems, including vision problems seen with children and with adults with ADHD, ADD, dyslexia, and learning disabilities. Dr. Applebaum has been featured on the front page of USA Today, in the New York Times, Bethesda Magazine, and as the cover story of OT Advance, so we can really believe everything he says today. He is the owner and managing doctor at Applebaum Vision PC, a private practice specializing in vision therapy and rehabilitation. He's a board-certified fellow of the College of Optometrists in Vision Development and an adjunct clinical professor at the Southern College of Optometry. So welcome. We're so excited to have you. Those are some amazing credentials. We're so excited to have you. Welcome.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here. And the work you're doing is so needed. And the patients we work with and the families we help need more people like us spreading the word and recognizing life doesn't have to be as challenging as it is.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the things that I always tell everyone that comes on and the people that listen is that the purpose of this podcast is really to give parents hope and then also to give them a lot of information, right? Because a lot of times they're going every which way trying to figure out what to do and why. And so to get answers to those questions, that's why we bring experts like you on to just really talk to them and help them figure out all of these pieces that are all over the place and just kind of put them together and start getting answers a little by little. Yeah. One of the things I love asking anyone who comes on is what got you into vision?
Great question. So I am a success story of the work that I do. When I was little, I had substantial developmental delays as well as visual developmental delays that contributed to an abnormally high prescription, reduced eyesight, difficulty navigating through space, lots of sensory integration issues, tactile defensiveness. I would see crumbs on the table and immediately go vomit and had a lot of challenges. So I was fortunate enough to have a mother who was an occupational therapist and a father who was a developmental optometrist who basically created the practice that I have now to kind of meet my needs. And so first practice in the country do OT and VT together. And now there are a few others, but I went through a lot of work and attribute all my success in life athletically, academically, and personally to what I was able to teach my brain in terms of how to navigate the world and establish order from a lot of disorder. And, you know, I, like so many of our patients, I really deeply understand what it feels like to feel different and to, you know, be the last one picked for sports and, you know, to have tears with homework and to be frustrated with things and reluctance to reading and the whole list.
Yeah.
But then also how awesome it is to really turn those challenges into strengths and be empowered by, you know, really coming out on the other side of all of that.
Yeah.
And so many people have vision problems that are hidden and they're struggling unnecessarily. So my main mission is just to empower everyone listening to know that there are signs and symptoms of treatable vision problems that can so dramatically influence behavior in a positive way.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that you're such a great example to parents when they see a lot of these symptoms in their own kids that, you know, with work, I mean, and it wasn't It wasn't easy, but you did all the work that it needed to. You had supportive parents that, put in all of that work with you. That there is a way out, right? There are answers to a lot of these troubles that our kids are going through.
And all three of my kids didn't have a choice. They've all been doing OT and VT, and honestly, I think everybody should be in benefiting from those services. But on top of that, so much can be done from nutrition and wellness from what you're doing, and I can't even imagine how faster my recovery or my journey would have been had I known what you know and what you work with so many of your clients on now.
Yeah, and I think that that's where that's a sweet spot where you're working on your diet, your nutrition, but at the same time you're helping support all of these kids with the right therapies, right? Anyone who asks me, they come to me like, "Oh, so if we're doing diet and nutrition, we don't need therapy." And I'm like, "No. You got it all wrong. We need therapy because you need to help them learn and unlearn a lot of these things, but the diet and the nutrition is helping your body get the most out of those therapies, right? Like it's not either or, they're both supporting each other and helping that child thrive.
And really the diet are the ingredients for our body and for our brains
Exactly.
and instructions on what, how to function.
So just tell me a little bit more about vision therapy. I'm
Yeah.
sure a lot of people haven't heard about that.
And most people haven't, and it's kind of crazy. So vision therapy, I kind of describe as it's like physical therapy for the brain through the eyes, with the intention of kind of arranging the conditions, to simulate how we use our visual system in life to raise to somebody's awareness what they're doing so they can learn how to self-correct, self-monitor, and essentially rewire the software in their brain to change how they're using their visual system. So many vision problems are in response to stress from our environment. And if we don't have the tools in place to meet the demands of that stress, we adapt. So most vision problems are actually brain problems manifesting through the eyes. So vision therapy addresses it on the brain basis by, establishing equality between each eye's functional skills and the ability for the eyes to work together as a team, and the depth perception that comes when our brain turns on to the information that our eye sends it, and really makes it so that we're building from a broad foundation to a fine-tuned point to have vision be that dominant sensory system that is guiding and leading and helping somebody achieve at their ceiling.
And so when a lot of kids that are coming to you, what kind of symptoms them parents really need to be seeing in their children to really bring them in? I mean, if it's up to me, I'd probably say every kid should at least get screened for it,
Yeah.
but what are we
Well,
really looking for?
great question. I mean, to hit on your point with every child should be screened for this, most eye exams, they're looking at eyesight and eye health. And that's important, but really the functional skills are what matter. So a developmental optometrist, a functional optometrist, a behavioral optometrist, those are the ones who are at least doing those screening tests. So we can even talk about some of the screening tests to kind of know what are some potential signs of a challenge. But really the kind of profiles with a lot of the kids that we work with are really smart kids who are kind of almost smart in everything but school. They're showing signs or symptoms of difficulty attending to tasks or by being distracted by things in the periphery, or there's a huge resistance or reluctance to reading. Or they prefer to be read to, but when they have to read with their eyes rather than their ears, it's like, oh my gosh, this is a completely different child. And especially with reading, there's really the characteristic symptoms or behaviors are, trouble keeping their place, losing, whether it's jumping and skipping words or lines, rereading, being distracted when they're reading, reduced comprehension with reading, kind of getting all wiggly and getting that motor outflow because it's so hard to attend visually. And then, the characteristic symptoms of like headaches and eye strain and blurry vision absolutely are there, but almost any child is not going to speak up to their parent or to an educator to say, oh, I'm noticing XYZ and this is normal. And even like the double vision or the words moving when they're reading, I would say 9 out of 10 times, the first time the child even brings it up is with me when I do a test that says, wow, you have really fragile eye coordination up close. is it hard for you to see a single word when you're reading? And it's like, oh my gosh, this person actually knows what I'm going through. But in their mind, that's normal. That's how all kids
Yeah,
read.
exactly. Yeah. And that's what I always say. Like, these kids don't know any better. They think that this is what is normal for everybody. It's just because they don't have anything to compare it to, right? And so they would think everyone's struggling with reading. But from a lot of things that you're talking about, I think when parents listen to that, their first instinct will be that these kids probably just have dyslexia, right? So they have issues with just making sure it's you know, just the way the words are on the page. And but it could be more than that, right? It's not just dyslexia that we're talking about here.
Absolutely. I mean, if you just take dyslexia as a word, in the definition, you look it up, it says difficulty reading words.
Yeah.
I would argue 98% of the people I work with have difficulty reading words, but because of a vision problem that is influencing the ability for the brain to converge and track and focus and process the information and then have the brain filter that information to know what to do with it. And, you know, absolutely there is dyslexia where language centers and auditory processing centers and visual centers are not communicating appropriately. But I would argue in most dyslexia, and when I say dyslexia, it's the label that was slapped on somebody, there's a visual component that at a minimum is influencing the ability to read. And if you address the vision stuff, which is all treatable, maybe that ability to read changes dramatically. Maybe it's we go from a reluctant reader to an avid reader, and in some cases it's just easier to aim and focus the eyes. But you know, it's a label that's thrown around often. And it's, you know, I'm very big on, well, what do we do about these labels? What do we do to make life easier and to eliminate some of these symptoms? And
I completely agree with that. Yeah. I mean, just saying that a child is dyslexic doesn't mean anything for him, because we still want him or her to learn, to be able to read and to correct it. Like, I mean, there are ways to do it, and that's why they come to you, right? To fix all of that and to be able to function. Right. One of the things I heard you kept talking about was function of vision, right? So connecting those things. Do you want to talk a bit more about that?
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting is in the US, I mean, so many kids now are entering kindergarten already reading, let's say. And I would argue that most kids are not visually ready from a developmental milestone standpoint to support those demands. And then very often, if they're being asked to read earlier and earlier, even if there's not a desire to, you know, you're embedding a challenge, and then a gap emerges between chronological age, visual developmental age, and then that gap gets larger as the demands increase. So I think is that similar in you
and,
know,
and
where you
I
are
was just
as
gonna
well?
Say it's really funny that you say that. So my son, when he was in kindergarten last year, he was reading above grade level. But the trouble with that is that he didn't have the accompanying comprehension, right? So he was reading books that first or second graders were reading, but he didn't have the ability to comprehend what he was reading. So he wasn't retaining the information. So for him, the words were easier to go through, but that comprehension, and just like what you said, there's so many things at the back, like so many pieces that are connected to just, you know, your ability to read the words. And I think that he had that gap where we had to work with him to kind of bring them both back to the same level, you know, drop the forcefulness of getting him to read higher levels and just bring him back down to reading basic things, but catching up comprehension with it.
Reading can be very tough. And for people who, you know, have no issue with it and just devour books, they take it for granted. You know, from a vision standpoint, every skill that is required for reading are skills that are learned skills. When everyone is born, they're not in place. Through our life experiences, we develop the ability to use our eyes together. But then if cognitive development and vision development aren't kind of progressing at the same rate, it can be challenging to process that information and to create the images in your mind that support the words, and then have those images flow into a movie, and then have that movie be compared to past experiences.
Yeah.
And that's an intricate process. But it's, I think the fact that your son is able to decode and is fluent going across, I think that's huge. And then there's strategies that can be done to help with that, the processing of that information.
Yeah. And I think that's something that a lot of parents of children on the varying spectrum, so whether it's ADHD, whether it's autism, whether it's sensory processing disorder, that's one of the things that they see with their children as well, right? Like this gap in their ability to just kind of make sense of what they're seeing and what the body and their mind is decoding, right? And one of the things that I read that you do at your practice is integrate mind, body, and vision. And so that's really what these parents are trying to get a sense of is how do we make sense of everything that we're either seeing, and how to integrate that, right?
When with sensory processing disorder and sensory integration dysfunction, I'm of course very biased, but vision is the dominant learning sense. And it is the sense that, is our first connection with so much of our world. In my opinion, it's hard to have sensory processing disorder, sensory integration dysfunction, and not have vision be involved or impacted. It's just a matter of at what level. And so often, the brain has a lot of difficulty taking input from all the senses simultaneously and organizing it and then filtering it and knowing how to then derive meaning and direct the appropriate action, which, I work with a ton of patients with head injuries or acquired brain injuries where that is all disrupted and those neuronal networks are completely then damaged, or they're finding other ways to compensate, and we're literally having to put the pieces of the puzzle back together from a global development standpoint and kind of backtracking and then moving forward and filling in the gaps. But absolutely.
And so just kind of touching back with children with SPD, the vision plays such a big role, but like there again, it's a spectrum, right? So there are kids that are sensory seeking, there's some that are sensory avoiders, right? And so vision plays such a different role for both of them, right? On one end, vision can be overstimulating, and for others, it can be something that they're just clamping down on. And so what kind of strategies do you use for either of them? Because I'm assuming they're different in the way how you treat that.
So we have two pathways in our brain that respond to processing visual information. One that's central information and one that's peripheral. In a normal, healthy brain, in a perfect scenario, our brain is using those systems simultaneously to know what's in front of us and what's around us. So often, those sensory seekers or sensory avoiders have so much to do with the integration of those two central and peripheral processing pathways. And very often, somebody who is a sensory seeker, let's say, is very heightened in terms of what's in the periphery, but has poor control over eye movements. And you look at any eye movement as a change in attention, whether it's voluntary or involuntary. And if you have difficulty controlling eye movements, you're going to have difficulty controlling attention. So that sensory seeker goes on to a new playground or new environment and just has this flood of input from the periphery and has to go up and rely on other senses, tactile maybe to touch it, or to really understand more because they can't touch the world visually. And then vice versa, the other person who's a sensory avoider, gets overwhelmed and has to sit back and almost locks in tunnel vision centrally to be able to take things in. And so they're on that playground or in that classroom setting, and they're looking here and here and here, but they can't take it all in. So opening up periphery is so huge for children with sensory challenges, because the more peripherally aware we are, the easier it is to localize what's in front of us. And there's lots of really cool strategies and tips that parents can do with their kids with stuff like that. You can even, as simple as like taking pictures of your family and scattering them all over a wall or sticky notes, and have the child with a flashlight, you're calling out a number of the sticky note or picture, and you're having them move the flashlight and their eye to that picture at the same time, but they're taking in everything else to scan and absorb and then localizing where it should be. But in doing that, make sure there's not a head movement. So maybe put a beanbag on their head or something. But the organization of space is huge for understanding sensory input.
And I think that's a really cool strategy. And I think a lot of parents just listening to you are probably saying, "Oh wow, like that's my child," right? Because a lot of parents kind of feel like they feel alone in this whole thing, or unheard or understood. And I think that, when you say exactly, give us those examples, are such a great way for parents to kind of connect and find hope that, there's something that they can do for their kids in that way. Just kind of changing pace a little bit, but I mean, not a lot. But children with ADHD, for example, right, when they're sitting in classrooms, vision is such a big thing. And one of the things I always tell clients is, have you done a vision test before you really agree with that diagnosis, right? Because oftentimes, just their inability to read or use their vision correctly can contribute to all of the symptoms that we see with ADHD.
Yeah. So there's such a huge component with ADD or ADHD that's visual, that's treatable, and that can significantly influence behavior.
Yeah.
And bringing up vision testing is huge, but you know, make sure everyone listening, it's not eyesight testing, it's eye teaming, it's vision testing. So, you know, there's three specific diagnoses or three specific behavior profiles that have a very high correlation with inattentive behavior. One of them is something called convergence insufficiency, which is getting a lot more traction. There's research and literature to support the efficacy of the treatment for it and how to diagnose it. But it's a very simple taking a target and with a little bit of a focusing demand on it and bringing it down the child's midline and saying, tell me as soon as you see two of these. It should be effortless to the nose, should be one all the way in. You know, research says 10% of children, I think it's probably closer to 25% of children, have a reduced near point of convergence, meaning it's harder to converge their eyes than it should be. And then it's harder to focus the eyes and it's harder to then process that information. And so when you're asking, when we have to converge our eyes, that occurs with near desk tests, when we have to read or write.
Yeah.
So if we're looking down and we have this fragile eye coordination system or our eyes aren't working well together as a team, you know, really simplified, if you can't control visual attention, how are you going to be able to sustain cognitive attention compared if that was not the case?
Yeah.
And then going along with that, the focusing system is the inside muscles. So convergence insufficiency or convergence or eye teaming is the outside muscles. Inside muscles are responsible for how our eyes focus. In a normal scenario, kids are using inside and outside muscles together in synergy. But very often, there's a spatial mismatch where we're aligning our eyes behind where something's located or in front. And there's just this, we're not really sure where to aim our eyes unconsciously.
Yeah.
And if we can't make something clear or there's a rivalry or competition over our eyes information in our brain ability to process that, how are you going to be able to then focus up close and anything that happens in the periphery, like we spoke about before, you have to disengage and move your eyes there in order to understand what that is. And so in a classroom setting, very often, especially with kids with sensory processing challenges, they're relying on auditory rather than vision to take in what's being presented. And so a child who's being asked to do all this near work and all of these assignments as the teacher's walking around and working with other kids, if the teacher's then presenting information, very often the child has to look away to really lock in auditorily what's going on. And so it gives the appearance or that they're not paying attention, but in fact, they're relying on their ears, not their eyes.
Yeah. Oh my God. I think for so many kids, that's a big relief just to, you know, I mean, all the time, like when you'll hear parents hear the teacher saying he's lost in space and lost in his own world, but that's probably not the truth. Is he's trying harder than most other kids. And that's one of the things I see again and again, all these kids. We think that they're not trying harder, but they're trying
harder than everybody
else.
Yeah.
Right. And go for it.
Well, so they're working so much harder than everybody else. They're not getting the same return on their efforts. They feel different. They're frustrated. And, you know, that's a child who loves to be, who prefers to be read to by mom or dad rather than read on their own, or who prefers math rather than reading because there's so much less decoding of symbols with math versus with reading. All of these symbols are then merged together and you get lost on the page. And it's just very often related to eye movement control.
Yeah. And it's something that you said earlier, was that, you know, when they're not able to focus, when they're sitting on the desk, when the words and the things that they're seeing, they're just going to get up and the wiggles will start, right? They'll start moving their body instead to kind of just make, to balance that. Right. If they're not able to visually concentrate, they have to do something with their body then. And so they start moving their bodies. And that's where like that whole hyperactivity aspect kicks in, where the teacher's like, he doesn't sit in place, or he's causing a ruckus, or he's, you know, distracting others. He's trying to integrate his body or her
body. Teachers are going to hate me saying this, but kids should be taking as many breaks as possible with reading and near tasks. And I'm sure a lot of listeners have heard of the 20-20-20 rule. That's kind of gotten some popularity over COVID, which basically means taking a break for all New York or computer work, taking a break at least every 20 minutes for at least 20 seconds and looking at least 20 feet away, but basically disengaging and letting the eyes relax. For kids, that should be way, it shouldn't take 20 minutes. We should be taking breaks a lot sooner than that.
Yeah.
And the wiggles, that motor outflow is a lot of times how we can kind of ground ourselves and what is needed. But, you know, having somebody do a couple minutes of solid handwriting work, and then they're able to get around or do jumping jacks or whatever, and then come back, it's going to be more efficient use of time and the child's going to get so much more out of the work versus saying, sit down until this is done. And it's taking hours.
Yeah. And if there's this need to really reassess the way how we're teaching our kids. My son's in a progressive school, so progressive learning school. So they're not mandated to, they don't even have desks for every child. They're just like workspaces that you move to through, and you learn what you want to, how you want to. So if they're teaching, say, 2+2,
awesome.
I know, it's really cool. There's a need for that everywhere. You know, we're putting so much stress on our kids to have a very like uniform way of learning, which is just really not what our future is out there as well, right? And that's where our kids who have vision issues, they struggle because it's so structured and they're expected to do everything a certain way. Their body's telling you it can't adapt. I mean, it needs to adapt, and you're not allowing it to adapt.
Is in your son's school, what are they doing with tablets and computers? Are they introduced early on, or
he's in grade one? They haven't introduced a ton of it. There's some of it, but they're trying to do a lot of like play learning. So if they're teaching you math and things like that, they'll have 4 different stations and teach you how to do math in like very unique ways, like jump 4 steps and add 2 more steps to that. And like, you know, teaching you how to learn and then analyze rather than learn like, you know, the way how we're traditionally taught math. And it's a very like unique way and unique spin on learning, which you see a lot of kids with wiggles enjoy that because they're able to learn and they're not forced to sit down the whole way through.
And that's so important. I mean, at some schools near me, kids are given tablets as early as kindergarten and first grade. And there's a reason why now their myopia or distance blur is becoming an epidemic in our children. And it's similarly to what we were saying earlier about, you know, reading before we're ready. We're not meant to be staring at screens all day long. Yeah. And screens present this really robust challenge visually that allows the focusing system and the eye coordination systems to operate entirely differently than they would otherwise. So much of life is in three-dimensional space. We need to have learning take place in three-dimensional space. But myopia is becoming a huge problem. I think it's estimated in the U.S. by 2050 that 50% of the population will be myopic. And unfortunately, you know, most doctors will treat the symptom of distance blur, which is here's a pair of glasses, let's make them stronger. That becomes your new normal. You adapt to that. And then you're on the cycle where you need something stronger to maintain that same clarity. But very often it stems from the near visual stress, not having the tools in place to meet those demands. If you establish the visual skills and abilities to support screen engagement, even though we shouldn't be on screens, you can dramatically decrease that progression and in some cases reroute that from even occurring.
Yeah. And does that have anything to do with when like a lot of parents that I speak to, and I see that with my son as well, like if there's more screen time or if there's any screen time, when you get them off, you have all of these meltdowns and things like that. Is it, a lot of it has, I'm assuming, has to do with vision and your ability to just make sense of everything.
Absolutely. And the self-regulation and the self-monitoring. And it's like the transition of screen to no screen, the different areas of the brain are activated that were literally suppressed when all the information is just being fed to you, and the dopamine hits that occur from that. Absolutely. And I think very often you can kind of notice your child just zones out on the screen.
They do.
And literally like they're letting go of focus. They're letting go of eye coordination. And, parents always ask me, like, what is the limit? What is the
Yeah, I was going to
recreational
ask you that
swing
too.
time? So, I mean, I'll give, so I have limits for different age groups, but I would say in general, you want to balance as much time on screens as you can with at least that same amount of time outdoors. And so many kids are outdoors so much less than they ever have been. But less than 18 months old, I usually say screens are only for a FaceTime interaction with a loved one who's not local. And otherwise, do not use screens as babysitters because literally you're presenting problems that are going to come way sooner than they would, and maybe they would have been avoided. 18 to 24 months, again, limit as much as we can, but I usually say at 30 minutes max and have it be really high quality material that is valuable and there's learning that's taking place. Under 5, I usually say not more than an hour a day. And again, balance it out. And then for everybody else, the American Academy of Pediatrics says 2 hours max. Definitely we shouldn't do that. And if
That's a
there's an
lot.
opportunity, that's a lot. That's terrible. If there's an opportunity to engage in real life, let's do that. There also are glasses that are therapeutic in nature that aren't compensatory, meaning they don't do the work for somebody, but they kind of act as a support system to engage, to improve performance and allow the brain a better opportunity for the eyes to work together and for the focus to be relaxed slightly. That can be wonderful in terms of protective. And there's kind of different models, some that have a small amount of prism that makes it so the eyes don't have to converge as much. I'm less of a fan of those as I am with very low plus lenses with a blue light filter that basically gets the brain a better opportunity to support that high contrast, high energy information that's coming out.
And I think that what we're also forgetting is that our kids, because of the way schools are, they a lot of their learning is on tablets as well, right? And so that is screen time that a lot of parents are not even thinking of. So they might already be hitting that 2 hours while they're in school for sure.
Oh,
And so there's
usually.
probably nothing left at home.
Well, and that's the other thing. I mean, you're at school on tablets, you're grabbing your parents' phone at appointments and then the television. I mean, screens are everywhere.
They
And I
add
think
them.
rather than saying like freaking out about them, I mean, this is the world we're in, but let's be mindful and have good intentions with what we're doing. And in general, the larger the screen, the farther away, the better. So if somebody has a choice of watching something on a handheld phone buried in the corner like this, or on a huge TV in the distance, this gives you a great excuse to go buy a huge TV and have it be as far away as possible.
And then also you hold the remote, right? So you have
Yeah.
all the control when it's turning on and off the
Absolutely.
phone, and like chasing your child around the house with your phone, that could be a nightmare.
You sound like you know what my house looks like
Talking with
sometimes.
experience.
Yep.
Yeah, well, thank
Absolutely.
you so much for coming on. This conversation has been amazing, and I feel like parents have a lot to learn. And can you tell us a bit more about where parents can reach you, where they can come and maybe use your services in the States? That would be amazing.
Absolutely. So I recently launched a big social media presence, Instagram profile. So you can find me on Dr. Bryce Applebaum. I have my practice website is applebaumvision.com. We see a lot of people from out of state or out of country who come in for intensive programs and almost like a boot camp. So that's always an option. And then also drbryceapplebaum.com. Is a wonderful resource for concussion rehab and there are supplements and lots of other things that can help support brain health and there are ways to work virtually, but so much of what's needed really does need to be in person. And so I do want to give a plug for COVD.org, which is the College of Optometrists and Vision Development. That's the international organization that board certifies doctors in vision therapy and rehabilitation. There's a great section on there that says locate a doctor, and you can type in your country, your zip code, and it'll tell you the closest people around. You definitely want to find somebody that has the letters FCOVD after their name, which means they're board certified in vision therapy and rehabilitation. And then there's a box on the bottom that you can check that also filters those people out. But I know from where you are and having seen more than a handful of patients from your neck of the woods, this is not even close to as popular or prevalent in terms of providers as it should be in the US. And as we extend to other countries, it gets even harder.
No, I think that I'm definitely going to try to come and get a boot camp next year as well for me and my family, because I think it's just if we're proactive about a lot of these things, we can all get so much further. Like our kids can just exponentially improve. Like you said, you've done that, but you've worked with children and athletes, for example, who've done that. So I think that there's only good things coming out of it, and nothing to harm your body. So thank you so much for all of your advice and all of your research and things that you tell us about. So I hope everyone listens
Huge pleasure
in.
to be here. Thank you so much for having me, and I love the work that you're doing, and this is a pretty powerful 1-2 punch to really help our kids thrive and get to a better place.
Oh yeah, for sure. I hope you enjoyed our conversation today. Thank you for listening to this podcast and spending your precious time with us at Helping Children Thrive. If you find this podcast helpful, please share it with your family, friends, and others who may benefit. If you haven't already, hit subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. Please take a few moments to rate and review this podcast on the review section of Apple Podcasts. This will help other parents, caregivers, and professionals find the show more easily. Visit MominaSaleemCoaching.com to post comments on today's show or ask any questions about upcoming episodes. And sign up to receive a weekly update. Helping Children Thrive is not a substitute for working with a qualified healthcare professional. The information shared here is not intended to diagnose and treat your child. Before implementing anything discussed here on the podcast, make sure to consult your healthcare practitioner. See you all next week.